Mr. President, Iraq's WMD turned out not to be there, and now Iran halted its nuclear program in 2003. Are you concerned that the United States is losing credibility in the world and now may be seen as the boy who tried, who called wolf?
I want to compliment the intelligence community for their good work. Right after the failure of intelligence in Iraq, we reformed the intel community so that there was a lot of serious considerations of NIEs in a way that would give us confidence. And here's a, I think, a very important product that is a result of the reforms we put in place. As a matter of fact, the American people should have confidence that the reforms are working and that this work on the intel community is important work. People say, well, why is it that you can't get exact knowledge quicker? Well, the answer is it's because we're dealing with a regime that is not very transparent. And frankly, we haven't had a very good presence in Iran since 1979. And that's why I instructed the intel community to beef up its intelligence on Iran so we could have a better sense for what they're thinking and what they're doing. And this product is a result of intelligence reform and, more importantly, the good hard work of our intelligence community. One of the reasons why this is out in the public arena is because I wanted, and our administration believed, that, one, it was important for people to know the facts as we see them. Secondly, that, you know, members of my administration had been very clear about the weapons program earlier this year, and therefore it's important for the American people to see that there's been a, you know, a reevaluation of the Iranian issue. David.
Mr. President, thank you. I'd like to follow on that. When you talked about Iraq, you and others in the administration talked about a mushroom cloud. Then there were no WMD in Iraq. When it came to Iran, you said in October, on October 17th, you warned about the prospect of World War III. When months before you made that statement, this intelligence about the suspending their weapons program back in 03 had already come to light to this administration. So can't you be accused of hyping this threat, and don't you worry that that undermines U.S. credibility?
David, I don't want to contradict an august reporter such as yourself, but I was made aware of the NIE last week. In August, I think it was Mike McConnell came in and said, we have some new information. He didn't tell me what the information was. He did tell me it was going to take a while to analyze. Why would you take time to analyze new information? One, you want to make sure it's not disinformation. You want to make sure the piece of intelligence you have is real. And secondly, they want to make sure they understand the intelligence they gathered. If they think it's real, then what does it mean? And it wasn't until last week that I was briefed on the NIE that is now public. And the second part of your question has to do with this.
Mr. President, thank you. Just to follow, I understand what you're saying about when you were informed about the NIE. Are you saying at no point, while the rhetoric was escalating, as World War III was making it into conversation, at no point nobody from your intelligence team or your administration was saying, maybe you want to back it down a little bit?
No, I've never, nobody ever told me that. Having laid that out, I still feel strongly that Iran's a danger. Nothing's changed in this NIE that says, okay, why don't we just stop worrying about it? Quite the contrary. I think the NIE makes it clear that Iran needs to be taken seriously as a threat to peace. My opinion hasn't changed.
On Tuesday at his press conference, when the president was asked about when he learned about Iran's nuclear program being halted, was he being completely candid?
Yes, he was, and I talked to you about that last night. I talked to your colleague this morning, and I'll reiterate it here. If you look at the rest of that sentence, the president was clearly told that there was new information that was coming in, but he wasn't told the details of it. And the president was also told that the intelligence community was going to need to go back and check out to find out if it's true. What I said is that McConnell told the president, if the new information turns out to be true, what we thought we knew for sure is right. Iran does, in fact, have a covert nuclear weapons program, but it may be suspended. He said that there were many streams of information that were coming in. They could potentially be in conflict. They didn't have a lot of confidence in the information yet.
But the president said, quote, he didn't tell me what the information was. But you're now saying he was told that Iran may have halted its nuclear weapons program and also that there may be a new assessment, right?
Right, but he didn't get any of the details of what the information was in terms of what the actual raw intelligence was.
He didn't tell me what the information was.
Okay, look, I can see where you could see that the president could have been more precise in that language, but the president was being truthful.
Janet, but listen to what he said. He didn't tell me what the information was. He did tell me it was going to take a while to analyze. Was the president told that there was a possibility that Iran's nuclear program could be suspended? That's what you said he was told.
Yes, the president was told that there is new information in the context of raw intelligence, not told the details of what it was, and told that they're going to have to go back and do some more checking on it because they didn't have a high degree of confidence in it and it could potentially be in conflict.
But he said he didn't know what the information even was. I can see the details of it. Right.
I grant you, he could have been more precise in his language, but if you look at the following sentences of that quote, he says, I have it right here. He says that it would take a while to analyze it. I mean, he's referring to it in terms of what the information was. I think that...
But he said he didn't know what the information was.
He did not know what the specific details were of the raw intelligence that they had found.
Just clarify one more thing. What day was the president actually briefed on the NIE? Well, because Mr. Hadley left the impression that it was last Wednesday.
On the NIE specifically. Yeah, last Wednesday.
Last Wednesday. Okay. Right. But there have been reports that the president briefed Prime Minister Olmert last week, maybe on Monday. Did he brief Prime Minister Olmert? And how could he brief Olmert on Monday about a report that he found out about on Wednesday? Can you clarify?
I will check. I mean, it's possible that he knew that there was information coming, the intelligence community was checking it out.
He didn't just find out about it Wednesday. That was like that. This was
the president
there.
Knew that. No, Ed, think about it. Think about it. The president was told that by McConnell that the NIE, he knew an NIE was coming. He knew that NIE was going to have to be delayed because they had gotten some new information. Jim, I'll get to you in a second. That the NIE was coming, that they had to check things out, they had to do some more due diligence, and then they would come back to the president. So we knew it was coming eventually.
The popular theory about beautiful blondes is that they are content to be merely decorative. Our lovely guest tonight, Miss Susan Blanchard, completely disproves that idea. Besides being a hard-working Fox starlet, Susan, I understand you're a wonderful cook.
I really love housekeeping, Mr. Keeley. But most of all, I enjoy the training I get at the studio. It's work, but it's fun, too.
You're an Easterner, aren't you, Susan?
Yes, a native New Yorker.
I thought so.
It was the Broadway theater that inspired me to think of show business as a career.
Well, that's interesting.
I used to save my allowance and go to every play I could. One of my favorite actresses was Jane Wyatt.
Uh-huh.
Imagine, Mr. Keeley, what a thrill it was for me to meet her right here in Hollywood.
Jane Wyatt's latest picture, Boomerang, was made in the East, I understand.
Mm-hmm, yes. But she and Dana Andrews, who stars in Boomerang with her, were in Hollywood to see a studio showing of the picture.
Oh, I see.
Jane Wyatt is my ideal of a stage and screen star. So talented and so lovely to look at. Just as lovely in real life, too.
She is indeed.
It wasn't long before I discovered that she's as keen about Lux toilet soap for beauty care as I am. You know, I'm a Lux girl, too.
We're glad to hear you say that, Miss Blanchard, because that's a very beautiful Lux complexion I see before me. Just right for blue eyes and ash blonde hair.
Thank you, Mr. Kennedy. Any girl in pictures is delighted to find out about Lux toilet soap as a beauty care. Active lather facials are so quick and easy, and they really make a difference in your skin.
Thousands of busy, attractive women have discovered that, Miss Blanchard. Daily Lux Soap Complexion Care does make skin lovelier. Otherwise, it wouldn't be the choice of 9 out of 10 screen stars.
Lux Toilet Soap is all-around beauty care for me. I use it as a bath soap, too. It has such delightful perfume, leaves a lovely fragrance on the skin.
Thank you, Miss Susan Blanchard. I hope our audience will be seeing that lovely Lux complexion of yours in a screen close-up one of these days. Now, back to our producer, William Keeley.
Act 3 of It's a Wonderful Life, starring Jimmy Stewart, Donna Reed, and Victor Moore. Numb with despair, convinced, as Mr. Potter said, that he's worth more dead than alive, George Bailey stands on a bridge, staring at the dark and frigid waters below. Suddenly, there's a splash.
Help! Help! I'm drowning! Help! Help!
No, that's not George. It's Clarence, the apprentice angel. And there goes George in after him.
Hello.
Jenny, can you tell us why you decided to put out this statement this morning about the New York Times story? Why did you feel compelled to respond?
Well, the subhead of the newspaper indicated that the White House, well, it says the White House role was wider than it said, implying that I had either changed my story or I or somebody else at the White House had misled the public, and that is not true. And I have heard now from the New York Times that they will retract that headline, and they are going to run a correction tomorrow.
But the underlying facts, four White House lawyers, four named, knew about the destruction or the intent to destroy the tapes beforehand. Are you disputing that?
I have not commented on that in one way or another. Helen, I'm going to finish this answer. The White House has not commented on anybody's involvement or knowledge, save for me telling everybody that the president had no recollection of being briefed on the existence or the destruction of the tapes before he was briefed by General Hayden. After that, I did not comment on anybody's knowledge or involvement. And so if somebody has information that contradicts the one thing that I've said, then this would be true. But it's not. And that is why I asked for a correction, and the New York Times is going to correct it.
So you're disputing the characterization in that subject, not the underlying facts of the story?
I'm not commenting on the underlying facts of the story. I'm sticking with what I have done in the past, which is that
if these four lawyers were involved and the New York Times has information saying that they were involved, isn't that wider than you were saying? You're only saying the president had no involvement. Therefore, you're saying that, you know...
Well, if you want to defend the New York Times, then you might look at it that way. I look at it from anybody who... I think anyone who... And believe me, people that I've talked to, the reading of it, when I first looked at it, I felt that that was saying that I had misled the American public on this, and I have not. There is nothing I have said that has been contradictory. Under our Constitution, the press is free to speculate as much as they want, and they can report on as many former administration officials or unnamed current officials that they want to that contradict each other throughout these stories. I'm not allowed to do that. I am an employee of the federal government. I respect the request from the White House counsel's office that we not comment from this podium, and I have not. And for someone to imply that I had is offensive.
Well, that's the implication. You're the one.
You're the one who's drawing the implication. Would you have been happy if the subhead had read White House role was wider than previously understood?
I have not. What it says is that I had changed my story, and I have not.
It doesn't say that.
It does. That's how I took it. And I am not the only one.
It simply says that the White House does not comment on this, but it goes on.
That's not what it says in this headline, Bill. And there was an editorial decision that led to this subheadline, because if they didn't want to make this point to try to say that the White House had misled the public, why would they put it in boldface above the fold and then it's not supported by any of the facts or the contradictory statements in the article? I speak for the president and for the White House. This says that I was misleading, and I was not.
It doesn't say you. It doesn't say you at all. And there were other people in the administration.
The White House did not comment. The only thing that I have said from this podium is regarding to the president and his recollection. I speak for the White House. I represent the White House.
Why do you take it personally?
I'm not taking it personally. I'm taking it, and I speak for the White House. It's not a personal thing. The White House asked for a correction, and I would remind you, the New York Times is going to do one.
What's the correction you're going to say?
Why would it compromise the investigation for you to say one way or the other whether these officials knew of the tapes?
The question, some of the questions that you have that are legitimate questions that the public has and that the Attorney General and General Hayden has is who knew what when. And that is part of the inquiry, and so that's what they've asked us not to comment on.
People say, well, why is it that you can't get exact knowledge quicker? Exact knowledge quicker. Quicker. Exact knowledge. Quicker. People say, well, why is it that you can't get exact knowledge? Quicker.
quicker?
Well, the answer is because we're dealing with a regime that is not very transparent.
She looks ahead. She paints her toenails red. She's wet and wild. Typical 90s child. She makes hell move, me. She takes
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Iowa. You know, they said this day would never come. They said our sights were set too high. They said this country was too divided, too disillusioned to ever come together around a common purpose. But on this January night, at this defining moment in history, you have done what the cynics said we couldn't do. Have done what the state of New Hampshire can do in 5 days. You have done what America can do in this new year, 2008. In lines that stretched around schools and churches, in small towns, and in big cities, you came together as Democrats, Republicans, and Independents to stand up and say that we are one nation, we are one people, and our time for change has come. You said, the time has come to move beyond the bitterness and pettiness and anger that's consumed Washington. To end the political strategy that's been all about division and instead make it about addition. To build a coalition for change that stretches through red states and blue states. Because that's how we'll win in November, and that's how we'll finally meet the challenges that we face as a nation. We are choosing hope over fear. We're choosing unity over division and sending a powerful message that change is coming to America. You said the time has come to tell the lobbyists who think their money and their influence speak louder than our voices that they don't own this government. We do, and we are here to take it back. The time has come for a president who will be honest about the choices and the challenges we face, who will listen to you and learn from you even when we disagree, who won't just tell you what you want to hear, but what you need to know. And in New Hampshire, if you give me the same chance that Iowa did tonight, I will be that president for America. I know you didn't do this for me. You did this because you believed so deeply in the most American of ideas, that in the face of impossible odds, people who love this country can change it. I know this because while I may be standing here tonight I'll never forget that my journey began on the streets of Chicago, doing what so many of you have done for this campaign and all the campaigns here in Iowa, organizing and working and fighting to make people's lives just a little bit better. I know how hard it is. It comes with little sleep, little pay, and a lot of sacrifice. There are days of disappointment, but sometimes, just sometimes, there are nights like this. A night that years from now, when we've made the changes we believe in, when more families can afford to see a doctor, when our children, when Malia and Sasha and your children inherit a planet that's a little cleaner and safer, when the world sees America differently, and America sees itself as a nation less divided and more united, you'll be able to look back with pride and say that this was the moment when it all began. This was the moment when the improbable beat what Washington always said was inevitable. This was the moment when we tore down barriers that have divided us for too long. When we rallied people of all parties and ages to a common cause. When we finally gave Americans who'd never participated in politics a reason to stand up and to do so. This was the moment when we finally beat back the politics of fear and doubt and cynicism, the politics where we tear each other down instead of lifting this country up. This was the moment. Years from now, you'll look back and you'll say that this was the moment. This was the place where America remembered what it means to hope. For many months, we've been teased, even derided, for talking about hope. But we always knew that hope is not blind optimism. It's not ignoring the enormity of the task ahead or the roadblocks that stand in our path. It's not sitting on the sidelines or shirking. Hope is that thing inside us that insists, despite all the evidence to the contrary, that something better awaits us if we have the courage to reach for it and to work for it and to fight for it. Hope is what I saw in the eyes of the young woman in Cedar Rapids who works the night shift after a full day of college and still can't afford health care for a sister who's ill. A young woman who still believes that this country will give her the chance to live out her dreams. Hope is what I heard in the voice of the New Hampshire woman who told me that she hasn't been able to breathe since her nephew left for Iraq, who still goes to bed each night praying for a safe return. Hope is what led a band of colonists to rise up against an empire, what led the greatest of generations to free a continent and heal a nation, what led young women and young men to sit at lunch counters and brave fire hoses and march through Selma and Montgomery for freedom's cause. Hope. Hope is what led me here today. With a father from Kenya, a mother from Kansas, and a story that could only happen in the United States of America. Hope is the bedrock of this nation, the belief that our destiny will not be written for us, but by us, by all those men and women who are not content to settle for the world as it is, who have the courage to remake the world as it should be. That is what we started here in Iowa, and that is the message we can now carry to New Hampshire and beyond. the same message we had when we were up and when we were down, the one that can change this country, brick by brick, block by block, calloused hand by calloused hand, that together, ordinary people can do extraordinary things. Because we are not a collection of red states and blue states. We are the United States of America. And in this moment, in this election, we are ready to believe again. Thank you, Iowa.
Tangerines are hanging heavy, glowing marigold and hues, teasing a half-pale moon. And I feel a pull to the blue velvet dark and stars, stars, stars. Pink magnolia blushing and coy, savors the sun while she shines. You've got yours and I've got mine. Together we glide through the blue velvet dark and stars, stars, stars. All it takes is a little faith.
I saw some footage of an angry black crowd turning on a black policeman who the crowd suspected of being an informer, an agent, a traitor. And you were in the picture. You put yourself, thrust yourself between that angry crowd and that victim. Mm-hmm. Didn't you think you might be killed?
When you're standing at the edge of a sidewalk and there's a little child and there's a car coming along and the child walks across the street in the path of the oncoming car, do you stand on the sidewalk and say, if I go, I might get killed? You don't even think. You act.
Did you have fear?
Not at the time. It's afterwards. It's afterwards when you say, and I mean, when I saw some of that on television, I said, what in the name of everything that is good had got into me? No, because I think that most of us would do that.
Desmond Tutu was born in 1931 in an impoverished township in South Africa. He wanted to be a doctor, but wound up a parish priest and the prophet.
For until blacks are free, no one in this country is going to be free.
For 30 years, he was a leader in his people's struggle to end apartheid, the rule of white supremacy.
If you think you can stop us from becoming free, you are going to be stampeded.
The course was hard and costly.
The system tries all it can to destroy us. It won't succeed. God is on our side.
In 1984, Tutu was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize. 1 year later, even as his own people still could not vote, the Anglican Church enthroned him as the first black archbishop in South Africa. In 1994, millions of black South Africans, including Tutu, voted for the first time. Nelson Mandela was elected president. Apartheid was no longer the law of the land. But the nation's healing had just begun. Mandela asked Archbishop Tutu to chair the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. Its mandate was to document the horrors of apartheid and to sow the seeds of reconciliation between blacks and whites.
We do want to forgive, but I mean, we don't know how to who to forgive, yes, because we don't know the killers, you know?
He had a gun in his hand pointed at my forehead.
The act of opening the magazine was the detonating device for a bomb.
And then they said to me, today you are going to die.
During that period, you were suffocated.
How did you manage to sit there day after day and hear these stories of terrible things that people had been doing to other people?
It was terrible, but and I cry easily. That is, I mean, I broke down on the very first day, but I then said it wasn't fair. God, you couldn't allow this to happen because the media then concentrated on me instead of on the people who were the rightful subjects, the victims. And if I wanted to cry, then I would cry at home or in church. But I was sustained by prayer, yeah.
What was the worst thing about apartheid?
Ultimately, it's actually when it makes you doubt that you are a child of God. When you are subjected to treatment that begins to work in here, and you begin to say, hey, maybe they are right. Language is very powerful. Language does not just describe reality. Language creates the reality it describes. And so when they call you a non-European, a non-this, you might think it isn't working on you. But in fact, it is corrosive of your self-image. You end up wondering whether you are actually as human as those others.
This report that your commission released has been called one of the most important documents of the 20th century. What would you like of it for the world to take to heart?
I would hope, I mean, that the world would realize that there is no situation that is not transfigurable. That there is no situation of which we can say this is absolutely, totally devoid of hope. Because that is what people thought about South Africa. And that the star turns of this report are those we wrongly call just ordinary people. There are no ordinary people in my theology, but it is the small people, the ones who used to be non-entities. They are the stars. And for the world to know that those called, so-called ordinary people are incredible.
What do you actually do when you forgive someone?
Well, basically you're saying I am abandoning my right to revenge, to pay back. By the fact that you have abused me, you have hurt me, or whatever it is that you have done, you have wronged me, by that you have given me a certain right, as it were, over you, that I could refuse to forgive you. I could say I have the right to retribution. When I forgive, I say I jettison that right, and I open the door of opportunity to you to make a new beginning. That is what I do when I forgive you.
But the Buddhists talk of letting go of the past, dying to the past when you forgive, of letting loose of the sorrow that you have brought with you from the past. Is that what you're talking about?
The thing is, of course, that I don't know that you yourself are able, by an act of will, as it were, to let go of the pain. The will part of it, where you will, is deliberately to say, I am not going to let you victimize me and hold me in the position where I have an anger against you, a resentment, and I am looking for the opportunity to pay back. I am saying I want to let go of that, that right, and begin to work for the possibility of restoring the relationship.
Do I have to do anything, the person being forgiven?
For your own sake, the only way you can appropriate forgiveness is by confessing. That opens you. That opens you to the possibility of being able to receive it. It's like opening a window. You see, forgiveness can be likened to the fresh air that is outside, or the sunlight that is outside, and you have a room, and the windows are closed and the curtains are drawn. The wind is still out there. My forgiveness is still available to you, but it won't find access until you open the window and the light streams in. You draw the curtains apart and the fresh air comes in. You, by your contrition and confession, you're saying, I am sorry, forgive me, open, and my forgiveness enters your being.
We're talking here about genocide, torture. Are genocide and torture forgivable?
As a Christian, you have to say, are there things that are unforgivable? I'm afraid we follow a Lord and Master who, at the point when they are crucifying him in the most painful way, can say, pray for their forgiveness. And we follow the one who says, forgive one another as God in Christ forgave you. That is, for us, the paradigm. We may not always reach to that ideal, but that is the standard.
We seem to cause the forest fire. We're just the flicker of the flame. Now I set a light to everything. Now all I do is cause you pain. I won't keep secrets alive.
Of her childhood, Sarah knew there was something wrong with her. Ordinary kid games would leave her exhausted and panting for breath. In one year, when she was 8, she went to the doctor 14 times. Then, when Sarah finished 5th grade, her heart failed. She needed a transplant. She was 11. In the hospital, she had to stay flat on her back to prevent a stroke. To keep her weight as low as possible, she was fed intravenously. She had to pass up 2 hearts that became available because both times she was fighting off infection. Hundreds of people die waiting for a heart each year, and someone Sarah's age typically waits months and months, if they're lucky enough to even get one. But Sarah didn't have that kind of time. Her kidneys were also shutting down. And then, some news.
It was a Friday night, and I was really hungry, and they just started letting me eat again, because I was been, you know, fed intravenously, and then my tray was in the room, and my dad was sitting with me, and all of a sudden, I was really excited I was going to eat, and then they came in and took the tray out. And I was really upset. I was like, Dad, go find out why they took the tray out. I don't understand. I'm really hungry. And so he goes, and they tell him that there's a heart.
Sarah's mom, Laura.
David, her dad called, and he goes, well, it's a heart. We've got one. Well, we just started screaming and jumping up and down and dancing.
My heart, since it was three times the size that it should have been, the heart cavity was really large. And the donor that I got it from, the heart was, even though the person was my age, the heart fit well because it was a little bit bigger and but still healthy. And so it fit well, and even though the cavity is larger, it works. It fits.
I remember the surgeon telling us that it was a perfect heart.
What do you remember about post-surgery?
Oh my gosh, the first moment I came out of the medicine that they put me on, I remember feeling like I was drowning. I'm going to cry thinking about it because, you know, I hadn't breathed so good for so long, and all of a sudden I just felt like I was like drowning in air. It was really cool.
And the first time I got to come in and see her afterwards, I touched her feet, and you have to understand that her feet had been so cold for so long, and I had been warned that her feet were going to be warm, and I touched them and they were warm, and then that's when I knew that things were working good.
For most families, this is where it would end, maybe a thank you note passed through a social worker to the donor family. But Sarah's mom, Laura, wanted more. Whoever gave her daughter this heart had done something so important to their family, it felt strange not to know them better. But hospitals don't just casually release personal information. Donor families might get upset hearing directly from someone who's walking around with their loved one's heart. And a lot of recipients don't want to be reminded where their organs came from either. Sarah felt that way.
I didn't really want to know, because it was really, it's really, you know, personal, but also like, it's insane. I don't know, you don't know how to have a relationship with the people who saved your life. It's just really strange. I felt bad. I felt really guilty. And I know it's not my fault that, you know, the person died, but, you know, you can't help but feel bad. You know, to benefit from someone that's lost someone, you know? And that was the hardest thing. I didn't want to meet them and feel guilty about, you know, their child passing away.
Sarah's mom, Laura, though, didn't give up. And the hospital did give Laura a few basic details. The heart had come from a boy about Sarah's age, who lived in the Fresno area, about 2.5 hours from where Laura and Sarah lived. Laura's relatives went online and started doing some sleuthing. They discovered a boy named Lucas, who lived in the Fresno area. He died just before Sarah's transplant. His cause of death, murder. The investigation stalled there until one day, a couple of months after the transplant, Laura did something hospitals discourage transplant families from trying. She happened to be near Fresno on business. She stopped by the local newspaper to go through the archives. Lucas, the article said, was killed in an especially senseless crime. Members of one street gang taunted another, bottles broke, a car window was smashed. Two men seeking revenge entered the home of a rival gang member, a 16-year-old named Arcadio, who just happened to be Lucas's brother. When the intruder saw a sleeping figure, his face covered by a blanket, one of them fired 3 shots into his skull. But instead of their target, Arcadio, they executed Lucas, his innocent, 11-year-old, big for his age, brother. By the time Sarah was 14, 3 years after her transplant, she had gradually learned more details about her donor and his family. Letters had been exchanged. Her parents had gone down to meet Lucas's family. Sarah's parents had divorced by then. Her dad and stepmom hung a picture of Lucas on the mantel above their fireplace with other family photos. It was their way of honoring him, but it really upset Sarah.
I couldn't believe they did that. And even to this day, I can't believe they did that. That was, I thought, really insensitive. But, you know, that was their belief. They wanted to have it up, so I didn't go over to their house for a while. But that was how we solved that problem. So,
what was the part that was hard for you?
I don't know. It made it real. It was already very real to me that I had my transplant. You know, I have my scar and my stretch marks, and I have to go to the doctors all the time, but it made it like it was a real person who died. Instead of, me living, it was both.
But Sarah's parents continued ever so gently to encourage her to learn more about Lucas and maybe even visit his family. Sarah kept saying she wasn't ready, but then an event came that changed her mind. The trial date was set for Lucas's killers. Sarah insisted on attending. She wanted to give Lucas's mom moral support, she said, even though the thought scared her to death. She kept worrying, what if they don't like me?
Before I met them, I didn't want to disappoint them. And it's kind of, I don't know, it might sound silly, but I kind of feel like because of my transplant and Lucas didn't get a chance to finish his life, I feel like I need to be good enough for two lives.
Did you want to meet Sarah right away?
Kind of, but it felt weird because I didn't know if she was going to like our side of the family. We were different the way, she lives different and we're different. Cause,
culture?
Yeah. Because we're, we're totally different. We're Mexicans, that's why.
Yeah,
because we're Mexicans, that's why. I don't know.
You just didn't want to say it, I guess.
I was trying to figure it out. Because we were Mexican, that's why. And they were white. Yeah.
Their first meeting took place at the home of Lucas's uncle the night before the trial began. The extended family was there, all the aunts and uncles. When Sarah walked in, Maria and Miguel rushed to her side.
Estaba pensando que mi hijo, cómo fue que mi hijo que tiene su corazón de Sara.
She saw Sarah and she couldn't believe that her son's heart was inside of Sarah. And she said that Sarah's mom told her that when she talked to Sarah to try not to cry in front of Sarah so that she wouldn't feel really bad.
So, and what did Maria do?
Dice que cuando entró en el cuarto y la miraste, ¿qué hiciste primero?
Me puse a llorar.
She started to cry, she said.
Me puse a llorar.
And hug her.
Quería tenerla en mi brazo todo el tiempo.
Yeah. She wanted to hold her and not let go of her, she said, the whole day.
I had been told by their social worker that Maria, the mother, really wanted to feel Lucas's heart. And I had warned Sarah about that. I felt she needed to be prepared. So when she did meet the family, that this possibility would happen. Well, when she met them and Sarah gave Maria a hug, Maria's head was right against Sarah's heart. And so Maria could actually feel her heartbeat.
The next day was the trial. Sarah sat next to Lucas's parents, holding Maria's hand.
I'm used to watching, Law and Order SVU, and the courtrooms are really big, and it wasn't like that at all. It was pretty small. And they went into very graphic terms about what happened and how he was murdered.
Was that the first time you had heard in such graphic terms how he died?
Yes, it was. And then they showed pictures, and my mom, like, she tried to pull me away, but I wanted to see it. I guess part of me that wanted to see it, felt like Lucas had been through so much, and then he was murdered so horribly that, I shouldn't be a baby about what happened, because if he had to, you know, die like that, why should I, you know, turn away from what happened? The two men that were on trial were, like, really close to us. I think there was only, like, three rows of seating for people that are watching the trial. So that was, it was really strange being that close. Even though they didn't know who I was, the people that were on trial, they looked at me a few times in the eyes, and it really scared me. Like, I mean, I know they couldn't, they didn't know who I was or why I was there, but I felt like the person that they had murdered, you know, was part of him, was in me.
When the jury convicted the two men of murder, something lifted for Sarah. That verdict of blame was placed clearly where it belonged. It was then that she says she stopped referring so much to Lucas's heart. She calls it her own heart now. Still, in talking to Sarah, who's 19 now, it's clear she feels an enormous amount of pressure. She can't just take the second chance Lucas's family gave her. She has to constantly justify it, prove she's worthy of it. But it's unclear even to her what that means exactly, except that being an ordinary person isn't enough.
I don't know, it's just like a constant fear in the back of my mind that when they see me grow up, that they'll be like, wow, she really hasn't done anything great. This was, you know, I don't know why they would think that. I don't know why I think that, but they would be like, wow, that was a bad choice.
Lucas's family couldn't see things more differently.
She already made us proud already. Oh, yeah. Just being alive, and that's it. She is what she is, and that's the way she...
I think we'll always see her as kind of perfect in our eyes, either whatever she does.
Whatever she wants to be, that's who she is, and that's good.
A few weeks ago, Sarah celebrated the 8th anniversary of her transplant. For Lucas's family, that's 8 years of life that he's been able to give someone, 8 years of proof that his death wasn't all in vain. For Sarah, it's 8 years that she might not be alive if Lucas hadn't died. The heart has been in her almost as long as it was in Lucas. It is her heart. And yet, every time she feels it slowing down as she drifts off to sleep, every time she's nervous and it speeds up, there's that reminder.
Jo Wolfson lives in Santa Cruz, California. She's currently finishing her newest novel for young adults, Cold Hands, Warm Heart, which comes out next year. Every 12 minutes, another name is added to the National Registry of People Who Need Organ Donations. And each day in our country, 18 people die for a lack of donors.
Show notes at lies.com. I'm John Callender. Thanks for listening.